Good evening. I'm Terry Thornton. I'm Curator of Education. It's my great pleasure to welcome you to Tuesday Evenings at the Modern. Tuesday Evenings is an ongoing series here at the Modern. We will run this spring through, I think it's April 27th, but check me on that, see if that's actually a Tuesday. Next week we have Cabinet Magazine, a representative from Cabinet Magazine, Pastelogram, and Triple Canopy here to discuss the vibrant life and perceived challenges of today's art publications. We all know the nature of art writing and then the nature of trying to decide whether that's an online or a print endeavor. This is sure to be a lively and productive conversation that touches on the most contemporary and real issues of communication and art, as well as what is the broader culture that art engenders and shares. This is an extremely timely presentation, as I see it, since more and more creative thinkers are taking matters into their own hands and starting pop-up galleries, zines, blogs, and other collaborative efforts. So I invite you back next week and suggest that you come early to visit the galleries or just to go to the cafe and have dinner or drinks. I've been asked to tell you that as an incentive for you to come to our beautiful cafe and experience that before the Tuesday evenings, they are offering a very good deal on bottles of wine, on select bottles of wine. It's 30% off, so there's my advertisement, but it's actually a very worthwhile advertisement. They're so sweet to stay open to accommodate us. I'm not sure they make a dime, but they're sweet to do it. Tonight, I'm happy to introduce an artist who, while internationally recognized, is thought of in Texas as one of our very own. Trenton Doyle Hancock lives and works in Houston after growing up in Paris, Texas, and receiving a BFA from East Texas State in Commerce. Before completing his MFA at the Tyler School of Art of Temple University in Philadelphia, his work was chosen for the 2000 Whitney Biennial, which was the biennial that our own museum's chief curator, Michael Opping, was one of five curators for. That following year, the Modern was fortunate to be included as a venue for the life and death of number one, which began at the CAM in Houston and ended what is now Art House in Austin. The Modern is proud to own nine of the buy-and-buy portfolios of etchings and the impressive large-scale mixed-media work, and the branches become as storm clouds from 2003, which you can see on the second floor in the galleries of this museum now. Trent is well represented in the DFW Metroplex with his work handled by Tally Dunn Gallery in Dallas. His is one of, I have to say, the most spectacular pieces in the very impressive Cowboys Stadium collection. And his work was included in Out of Commerce that just closed at the MAC in Dallas. Some of you may have had an opportunity to see that. Trent's exhibition record spans the globe, including solo exhibitions, Trenton Doyle Hancock, The Wayward Thinker, which was organized by Fiona Bradley at the Fruit Market Gallery in Edinburgh, Scotland, in 2007. Wow, That's Mean, and Other Vegan Cuisine at the ICA in Philadelphia in 2008. Trenton Doyle Hancock, We Done All We Could, and None of It Was Good. And None of It's Good. These are supposed to rhyme, and I'm really wrecking them there. which was organized by the University of Florida Art Museum. And then a new body of work that I had the good fortune of seeing this past fall at the James Cohen Gallery, where Trent's work is represented in New York, titled And Then It All Came Back to Me, which I think is something that Trent might touch on in tonight's presentation. Trent's work has also been chosen for many, many biennials. I was kind of amazed. I think one every year for most of his life now. Those include, in addition to the 2000 Whitney Biennial that I mentioned, also the 2002 Whitney Biennial, as well as the 2000 Animix Biennial, in 2009-2010 at the Museum of Contemporary Art in Shanghai, China, the 2009 International Icheon Women's Artist Biennial in South Korea, the 2008 Prospect 1 in New Orleans, and in 2003 the Istanbul Biennial Poetic Justice at the Istanbul Foundation for Culture and Arts, and the Lyon Biennial in France, and I'm not sure what year that was. I think, in fact, he's done a couple of those biennials in Lyon. In 2008, Trent parlayed into the world of dance with Cult of Color, Call to Color, a collaboration with composer Graham Reynolds and choreographer Stephen Mills for the Ballet Austin, which received great acclaim, critical acclaim, with Eleanor Hartney of Art in America calling it an exuberant mix that swept the viewer along in a satisfying blend of sound, imagery, and movement. And the ballet was actually brought back just a couple of weeks ago for the fifth anniversary, so that has just closed in Austin. Trent recently received the Greenfield Prize at the Hermitage Artist Retreat in Elwood, Florida, and has also been acknowledged with the 2012 Houston Fine Arts Fair Artist of the Year in Houston, the 2007 Joyce Alexander Wayne Award from the Studio Museum in Harlem, the S.J. Wallace Truman Fund Prize in the 181st Annual Exhibition at the National Academy Museum in New York in 2006. Tonight he is here to share with us this new direction in his work as he presents in preparation of the Bring Back. Please join me in welcoming Trenton Doyle Hancock.
Wow. Thank you, Terry, for that introduction. It's good to be back here. My home away from home, Fort Worth Modern Museum. I'm going to be showing you guys a lot of images, and I'm going to be talking a lot. So might as well get going with this. This first thing that I have projected up here is... Yeah, I guess if the lights come down as far as possible, it'd be awesome. I usually start these things out with this image, and this is from one of my favorite movies, Superman, the movie from 1978, starring Christopher Reeve and Marlon Brando. I start out with this film because it's been my favorite movie since it came out. I've probably seen it probably 1,000 times, but it's meant different things to me over the years. Here lately, I've focused in on the idea of the artist or the blessing of the space as the artist, as one as for us, the superhero, or you have these things that you can do that maybe others can't do, and with that comes an obligation and responsibilities to change and to risk and sacrifice. And there's a point in that film where a young Clark Kent is receiving this knowledge for the first time. He's grown up to the age 18, and he's very confused about who he is. And he meets his birth father for the first time, who's played by Marlon Brando. And the scene takes place in the Fortress of Solitude. So what I'm going to do is just quote to you their exchange, because to me it's this very special and crystallizing, no pun intended, moment in this structure. "My son, you do not remember me. I am Jor-El. I am your father. By now you will have reached your 18th year as it is measured on Earth. By that reckoning, I will have been dead for many thousands of your years. The knowledge I have matters physical and historic. I have given you fully on your voyage to your new home. These are important matters to be sure of, but still matters of mere fact. There are many questions to be asked, and it is now time for you to do so. Here in this fortress of solitude, we shall try to find the answers together. So, my son, speak. Who am I? Your name is Kal-El. You are the only survivor of the planet Krypton, and even though you've been raised as a human, you're not one of them. You have great powers, only some of which you have as yet discovered. Come with me now, my son, as we break the bonds of your earthly confinement, traveling through time and space. So this first image is titled Frosty, and I made this in 1996. I was an undergraduate, and I was just starting on this introspective search, digging within myself, trying to find something that was familiar, something that I could call my own. So what I did was I turned to the mirror, and I made a painting of myself, very straightforwardly, on paper. And it looked like me, but it really didn't feel like me. So I went to my grandmother's garage, and I found this old mildewed green tarp. I took that and printed on top of it and glued the painting to it. And then it started to feel a bit more like me, but it wasn't enough. So I took a sander and I started to sand into the surface. And as I was eroding away those layers, what I was doing was unearthing something that seemed familiar. And then I took my paint and I painted over the top of all of that. And then and only then, after there was this kind of a history to the material, something that had been, I guess, encased in it, that I feel like I unlocked. So it was the fusing of my image versus what was inherently in these materials that then made something that I think felt like me. Thus starting my relationship to collage and this idea of layering a surface, tearing away at that, and then layering some more, tearing away, so on and so forth, until something feels historic about it. I'm going to talk a little bit about what performance means to me. This is an image from my first one-person show in a gallery. This was at Gerald Peters Gallery in Dallas in 1998. People came to the gallery. They were expecting to see an artist holding a wine glass, wearing a suit. And what they saw before them was something very unfamiliar. There was this wall, this heap, this mound of sorts, snoring. And they thought, what is happening? Well, every 30 minutes, an alarm clock would go off, and the gallery director, Mrs. Tally Dunn, would come in, flip on the lights, turn off the alarm clock, climb a ladder with a bowl of Jell-O, and begin to feed me. The assistant director, Lisa Brown, was underneath the armature, and she was blowing up balloons that corresponded to the color of Jell-O that I had just eaten. There were four different feedings, four different colors of balloons, and she would shove those balloons out the butthole of the creature, ending up on the floor, so there was balloon shit everywhere at the end of the night. And this is the residue of this performance. So what's left over, I felt very comfortable calling sculpture. I'm not trained as a sculptor, but I feel that I can have this meaningful relationship to it as the residue of these gestures or these performances. The things on the walls are plastic tops, which I had been collecting for about a year at that point. But those harken back to when I was younger, and I would collect plastic tops from around the house. When I was 2-3 years old, I would crawl around open all the cabinets and unscrew all of the detergents and cleansers and play with these plastic tops because they were the same size as my toys, the same shapes and colors and material as the toys. So I doubled my toy collection by doing this. But to me, they represented a kind of truth. And so in this moment, when I was an undergraduate looking for these tropes, these ideas, these icons that I felt a closeness to, because it was a very inundating thing to say, oh, the world is before you. You can take all of that stuff and turn it into art. Go. And it's just too much. So I had to look to my own past. And that narrowed it down a whole lot for me. Because here are these things that already have meaning. I can take them and try and understand them better. So these plastic tops got co-opted into the practice and became maybe my entry point into abstraction. This is a piece that was hanging in that show. And I thought, maybe this is what these mound creatures, how they think. Maybe they think in color. So this was almost like a sentence. The thing trying to say something to people, articulate something that was just about form and shape. This is the first mound that I believe I made with the this material, the fake fur and the felt. This is a piece called Coon Wound. This is the first mound that I made on canvas. This is the Beaver. He's a malformed mound. The title of this is, And Then I Saw Her Face, Now I'm a Beaver. This is an egromaniac five times fast. Coon Bear the Legend, Jr. Now I'll talk a little bit about veganism. When I was in graduate school in Philadelphia, I had never met any vegans before. I'd hardly met any vegetarians. This was a foreign concept to me that you don't have anything around you made out of animals and nothing goes inside of you that is animal. I thought, this is weird, but I was interested in learning about it. I was roommates with a couple of vegans, this husband and wife. And after a while, they became very preachy. It was hard to live with them. And I won't get into the details, but one of them started running a porno site out of the bedroom. So they had one, it was a webcam, and they had one customer. It's like, so they were very loyal to them. Anyway. This got to be a bit much, so I didn't know any way to get back at them except to draw horrible pictures of them, so that's exactly what I did. It made me feel a lot better. So here I am at the dinner table eating vegans for dinner. This is a piece called Salad. So when vegans get together, that grouping is called a salad. So I continued to draw these forms, these vegan forms, and the more I did, the more I stripped away their humanity. They became more insect-like, more alien-like, or goblin-esque, and they had bones protruding from places that just bones shouldn't be, and they became actually a lot more fun to draw, and they became like further away from the source material. So I was no longer thinking about my roommates. I was thinking about how to get to new ways of building a picture. So they became building blocks that I could just put away for when I needed them. Oh, and I don't know how that got in there. But this is Torpedo Boy. So when I was in about the fourth grade, I had just gotten glasses, and I wasn't feeling very good about myself. My self-esteem was really low, and what I did was I retreated to the picture plane. I started drawing these pictures of this superhero, so I became Torpedo Boy, and I would write stories about him, and he was this archetypal superhero. He'd always show up and save the day on time. He was super strong. he was my version of Superman. So it actually gave me a lot more confidence as I continued to draw that character. So when I got older, I brought Torpedo Boy back, and when he traversed that span of time, he took on some very adult qualities, I would say. He just became a lot more flawed. And that was also fun to exploit and to try and figure out. It's like, what is the relationship to the ego, to the artist, to the superhero, to this idea of strength and obligation, all boiled up into this one character. This was just a fun exercise. This is a piece called Leave Salem and Torpedo Boy stepping on someone's face. This is Torpedo Boy kills shoplifters, so don't shoplift. This is part of a 10-drawing series where I actually flipped the script. Instead of Torpedo Boy being the hero, he became sort of the antagonist in this story, where he goes into the underworld and the vegans are having their sacred meal, which is tofu. And he swipes all of their tofu away from them and ducks into an alleyway to count his new booty stash, and out of the corner of his eye he sees a beautiful prostitute named Trudy Fluso. So he approaches Trudy and offers her 2 blocks of tofu for her services, and she agrees. I won't get into what happens next, but it's crazy. This is the first mound meat that I ever painted, and this was from grad school. It's 6 by 9 feet, and it's called Wow, That's Me. And it's based on a small drawing I did of a little mound, and it's basically the same image except his head is inset in a little circle off to the side. And I think I was thinking about those old Wheel of Fortune shows where you'd win some money and then you'd go through this, your head would be inset and you'd go through a fake living room and buy things. I really kind of like that composition, so I think I gave you too much. But anyway, it gave birth to this painting. And this was one of the first canvas paintings that I carved into. So all the words, Wow, That's Me, are carved over and over into the surface. And then the letters that are carved out are then glued back on top. So there was this kind of push and pull, a little give and take of the surface that I was excited about. And then I responded to that with paint and other material. So I started to really establish and finesse this idea of, you know, painting and sculpture, and where does one end and another begin? But there's always this kind of obligation to the picture plane. But this was, I think, one of the first successful attempts at capturing this tense moment in between the two ideas. So anyway, after that, I continued, almost as if with the vegan idea, continued to make these mound meat paintings as a way to explore different compositional opportunities. So I'll talk a little bit about the extended field of painting, which is basically wall drawing. So this is a work that I did in that first museum survey here at the Fort Worth Modern in the old space, a piece called Who. And oftentimes I'll do these drawings on the wall. I haven't done one in quite a while because I'm kind of refiguring my place with this wall drawing stuff. But this is one of the first ones that I did outside of my studio. And it's basically to create a context to hang either drawings or paintings on top of. So what I'll do is I'll start with a module. That module will divide and multiply and become a total situation. So I'm in these for scale. This is in Rotterdam at the Museum Boijmans, the Folk Art Museum in New York. Well, that's a familiar piece, which is upstairs right now. But this was at the Istanbul Biennial of 2003. And they asked me what I needed for the space, and I told them a toilet. And like, why do you need a toilet? I thought it would be a nice place for people to sit and contemplate about the work. I mean, that's where I get most of my ideas. So now I'll just tell you some stories. So 50,000 years ago, there was an ape man named Homer Buctus. And Homer Buctus wasn't the smartest ape that ever lived, but he was very loyal to his family. He went out every day or every other day and collected food for his family. He was a great provider. He had a beautiful ape family, his wife, Alma Croing, and two beautiful ape children, Brutha Scam and Chromalina. Well, one day Homer Buctus went out into the field and he happened upon something that he had never seen before. It was a field of flowers that was so abundant with shapes and colors and different sizes of flowers, these beautiful prehistoric plants. He didn't know what to do. He was overtaken with emotion. So he began to masturbate in this field of flowers. And he left and returned the next day, and his seed had mixed with the flowers, and up sprang these hybrid creatures that were half human and half plant. And these were the first mounds. And the flowers, they began to speak to him, and they told him, "You have an obligation to these creatures. These are your sons and daughters." And he repeated the process and made more of these creatures. So he began to spend more and more time away from his ape family and more time in this field. So here we have a drawing called Fresher Field, or Fresh Field, and it's a small graphite drawing. This is one based on that. This is called Fresher Field, and there's about 1,000 baby mounds in this piece. And from that motif, I made this work, which is called Choir, and it's about 7 feet by 10 feet, and it's very rigorous and juicy in terms of its surface. But it's called Choir because all of the baby mounds are speaking their first words, which are colors. So I'll actually walk you a little bit through how this one was made. Here it is flipped on its face. I've already cut the letters, you know, words orange, red, green, so on and so forth, out of the surface. And I'm reverse appliquing felt and painted canvas and other things on the back so that they show through from the front. And then I start to paint in and around that information, and you can see that there's these negative spaces that are left where the mound information will be. And then I can collage other painted things in, like where their heads would be, these very kind of complicated painted things, and then start to go in with fake fur and felt and build their form. And also fake flowers are glued in. So it became this kind of a fun process-oriented piece to make. And here we have, you can get a sense of the scale of it. This is a work called We Love You, because the flowers began to speak to Homer Buctus. Homer Buctus, we love you, and we want you to be a loving and caring father to all of your new mound babies. So I basically used this as a guide for this work, which is also titled We Love You, and I thought it'd be interesting to see the words becoming the speaker, so the words are doubling over themselves and forming flowers. So part of this, what I call my Genesis body of work, I did 52 portraits of baby mounds, and I arrived at the number 52 by going through the alphabet twice, so each one is named after a letter of the alphabet. This is I, etc. This is expect sex. And I titled this one after one of my favorite horror films, Texas Chainsaw Massacre. At the beginning of that movie, the doomed children pull their bus up to a graveyard, and they get out, and next to one of the gravestones lying down is an old man, and he's clutching a gravestone with one arm and has a bottle of whiskey in the other, and he looks up at them and he says, "I see things." So the title of this piece is "I See Things." This is Mound Number One, the legend. You'll see a lot of him later. This is a piece of, it's kind of an irregular shaped sheet of paper that I have then drawn these flower forms on and then went in with like watercolor and fleshed them out a bit. But there's also chopped up fingers and hands in this garden, kind of representing the mounds, plant parts and human parts. And also accentuating like how grotesque all of this actually is. It's beautiful, but it's also this kind of dyspeptic act. And I took a few of these drawings and was able to work with a wallpaper designer, and we fused these together to find a repeat and came up with a wallpaper. And so you can see the painting choir and some of the baby mounds hanging on this, creating this kind of messed up domestic situation. This gallery in New York already has this giant living room kind of feel to it, but I think we pushed it a little bit further with this installation, with this kind of inviting yet repulsive kind of thing. So at some point, Brutha Scam and Chromalina, the two ape children, find out what their father has been up to, and they're so overtaken with jealousy and anger and hatred and confusion that they pick up tree branches and they stomp out into this field of flowers and they begin to murder all of these little baby mound creatures, and they're clobbering them over the head and choking them, and all of their pink juice, their mound meat, is flowing over the ground. Their blood and meat, and it's a really sad, horrific situation. And baby mounds are rooted in the earth because they're half plant. They can't get up and run away, so all they can do is wobble back and forth. So thousands of these creatures wobbling back and forth in fear created an earthquake. The earth split open and swallowed up Brutha Scam and Chromalina, and they were banished to the lower realm where they were forced to live out the rest of their days. While they were down there, they decided to create a race of creatures. They procreated and created an inbred race that was hell-bent on returning to the top of the earth and destroying the rest of the living mounds. And these were the first vegans. I know it's horrible. So this is wallpaper also that I made. That's black light and glowing. What is it? 3D, and it's just a crazy thing. So this is commemorating the Great Mound Massacre. So you can see these ape hands coming in and stabbing and doing all kinds of horrible things. I think one's shooting the finger at one of them. Just mean. So from that wallpaper, I actually made this painting, which is called "Wow, That's Mean," and it's sort of the opposite side of the choir coin, where that composition was very stable. I wanted this to represent upheaval, so there's many different vantage points. You can't tell really which way is up. It's actually a more overall kind of a composition than the other piece. And so here we have that painting on top of the wallpaper. Here we have some schmuck looking at the wallpaper. So Homer Bucktus, he knew he had to save the rest of his mound babies from these vegan aggressors. So he uprooted the remaining living mounds, and he drug them around to different parts of the earth and replanted them. And around each one, he sprinkled seeds in hopes that one day a forest would grow up and protect them from these vegan aggressors. So let's jump 50,000 years into the future. And this is closer to present day. So here we are in the forest. And here's another forest scene, but there are words this time. Get goat. Now I'll introduce you to the spirit energy named Lloyd. And Lloyd is a heavenly protector, and he kind of looks down over this realm, and he's the reason that we can see words within my paintings. He's very judgmental. Everything is black and white, but he's still a good energy. And here he is giving some sort of a cryptic message to this mound. Get goat. The messages are getting clearer and more intense. This is Friends Indeed. This is a 6x9 foot painting. And this is the most clear of these, what I call flashes. This particular one is a death flash because this mound is about to die. That's what Lloyd is telling him. This is a piece called Remember with Memory. And here we have, I decided to articulate that moment where the first puncture is taking place of this mound's skin. The vegans have made their way into the forest and are bleeding this creature of his beautiful mound meat, stripping of him of his fur and collecting his mound meat in buckets. This is a work called The Legend is in Trouble. And it's about, I don't know, 8x10 feet or so. And the way that this work is made, I wanted to bespeak the kinds of horrors that, you know, of the concept. It's like this war that's taking place, this orgy, this violent orgy of sorts. And they're pulling mound meat out of him, and it's this, it's kind of an action painting, but everything is very, sorry about that. It's telling me I've reached my caloric intake for the day. good timing. So the legend is in trouble. So this painting, I wanted to feel like it was stressed or it was in trouble. So there's a brutish quality to all of the marks and incisions. I actually slept under this painting for weeks as I was making it. I really wanted everything to be there. Like, this was my life as I was making it. And this is a work called A Yank, A Tug, and A Yank. Here we have vegans do their dirtiest work. And this, too, is study for this work called And the Branches Became as Storm Clouds. And this work is upstairs right now. And it's, I think, 8x8 feet or maybe 7x7. I can't remember, but it's essentially the same painting as The Legend is in Trouble, but I'm looking at the material through a different lens, giving myself the challenge of exploiting a different kind of atmosphere with the same subject. So this time there's a kind of a clarity to the way these creatures are spilling forward, giving me a chance to exploit the kinds of energies that you might see in old Disney cartoons or Tex Avery, the kind of whimsy that you might see in the Sunday papers, which was also very important to me. I started out as a cartoonist, and I feel like over the course of my career, I've re-engaged with the idea of cartooning in different ways. So this was a very important painting for me. I'm currently working on my first animation, so it's nice for me to go back and look at this painting for a while and kind of study it to see exactly what kinds of moves I was making. So you get a sense of the scale of it there. So this is a piece called Right Before the Fight Before. And so Lloyd and the spirit energy painter, and painter is the reason we can see color in my work, these two energies are now about to engage in battle over who gets this mound's soul after he dies. And here we have painter and Lloyd struggle for soul control. And so this is the battle that's ensuing. This piece actually just went up at the Blanton Museum in Austin, so if you make it there, you can check it out. Oh, and I should mention, the ballet is actually being performed all this week and into the weekend and ends next Sunday, and there may be some seats left, so if you want to make the trip to Austin, check ticket availability. So Here we have Painter and Lloyd's struggle for soul control. And Torpedo Boy figures back into this story. I discovered that he was actually the son of Painter and Lloyd, and he was sent to Earth to protect these mounds from the vegans because they have no way to protect themselves. But he arrives late to the forest and has to pay a toll to get in, so this is a piece called Toll. And here's a work called Too Late, where Torpedo Boy has finally made his way to this mound, and he's bleeding to death, and he's now Torpedo Boy is crying, and he's scooping mound meat on and trying to spackle it back onto this mound, and his tears are mixing with the pink blood of this creature. And this is Torpedo Boy tries his darndest to stop an oozing mound meat, and this is a monolithic work. It's about 12 feet tall. And I decided to show the frenzy of this situation by multiplying Torpedo Boy's hands, these yellow, dumbed-down hands. And it's almost like he's scurrying around trying to spackle this mound meat and pull it together to no avail. So here we have the legend breathes his very first death breath. The legend attempts to put out his own fire of life. So when the mound meat hits the ground, it becomes as fire, and it rises up and singes this mound's fur. And as an act to save himself, he shoots out cool streams of mound meat to put out the hot. But what he didn't realize is that he's fueling this fire, and the fires rise even higher and consume this creature. This is a study for the life and death of number one. And here we have the life and death of number one. And I chose to highlight the words, the fade of one. And you can see through this mound's body, his skeleton, and the mound meat melting off of his bones, forming a river around him. And here's a work called By and By. And the mound is he's died, and all of his fur and mound meat are gone. And what's left in the forest is a perfect tree with a skeleton, with a skull on top. And all the creatures from the forest and surrounding areas are coming to pay their last respects to this great creature. So this is Saint Sesum. Sesum lived in the second era of veganism. He was a vegan priest, and he was considered to be the world's first good vegan. Sesum, he meditated just as much as any other vegan priest. He kept Lloyd's law. He didn't have any material possessions. And he took his one sacrament a year, one block of tofu, and he was sort of content with this. But something in his nature was wouldn't settle. He knew there was something more to life, that life wasn't always maybe so black and white. So every night, Sesum would go to sleep, and the spirit energy painter would come and visit him, and she would show him one color each night. And since vegans are so inbred, they can't see color. Their eyes are so unused to that idea, so they only know darkness. But he was very curious. What are these things? What are these sensations that I'm seeing? Every night, she would show him a different color. And one night, she showed him the whole spectrum. And Sesum woke up waving his arms in excitement. He was so happy. He was overcome with joy. And before him was Painter. And she began to speak to him. She said, "Behold, Sesum, I am Painter. And these are colors. These are the sensations that have been withheld from vegan kind since the beginning." And she went on to describe how vegans came to be, which he had no idea, and that they were related back to humans, Homer Bucktus and mounds. and vegans, all related. This blew his mind, and she told him that vegans must try and regain their humanity by becoming friends with these mounds, as opposed to hating them and destroying them. And he must ask this mound to give some of the mound meat for these rituals, where they would take hits of mound meat and see colors, and through these colors they would become human again. So thus a new religion, a new kind of theosophy was born. So Sesum created what's known as the Cult of Color. He gathered up his 8 disciples, and they preached this message of color throughout the underworld. Sesum was very strong in the ways of color. Here he is walking on a sea of mound meat. This is Das Plimt. This is a work called Sesum's Dream. So painter's address to Sesum is written out in this work. This is a 5x5 foot painting. Behold Sesum, I am painter, and these are colors. And you can read it all the way around. This is a work called Sesum's Mission. So Sesum's, what he needed to do was articulated in this painting, which I've carved those words out of the surface of this work. Also a 5x5 foot painting. So Sesum had to walk through the forest. And this is a piece called Sesum's Chamber, where I'd made these hanging felt and paint and trash tapestries. There's 4 of them, and they create this room. And on the outside is the forest that Sesum walked through and his color-coded conversation with this mound. And that was a lot of fun to make. But the most fun was actually for me to be able to create a situation where people could see the backsides of these tapestries, something that they hadn't been privy to before. Furniture I inherited from my grandfather. I converted the dressers into speakers, which are playing Muzak versions of songs with colors in the title. The bed frame is housing 9 buckets of Pepto-Bismol, which is the stand-in for mound meat, representing Sesum and his 8 disciples. So when you walked in, you smelled crazy smells. You saw, you were enveloped by color and sound. I wanted this to be a crazy sensorial kind of a situation. This is a work called Cult Jam, where these vegans are conducting their crazy orgiastic rituals, where they're taking their hits of mound meat and seeing color. It's this kind of a hippie, crazy thing. Gave me an opportunity to deal with one of my favorite painters, Hieronymus Bosch. So this is the first miracle machine that I'm going to show you. Miracle machines were created by a vegan scientist named Beto Wachau. And Beto was the smartest vegan that ever lived. He had 5 brains, and he was actually brainwashed into being in this organization. He thought that this was all a horrible idea, but Sesum knew he needed Beto's expertise to create these new machines, which are built out of reconstituted dead vegan material, making a kind of bone lumber, which is creates an architecture called ossitecture. And the miracle machines work like this. You put mound meat in one end, and out the other end come color blasts that are so bright, unconverted vegans can see these colors and then become converted. So this miracle machine operates by thousands of little vegans sucking mound meat through straws. And when they ran out of mound meat, they had to go back on top of the earth and milk mounds to get more. So here we have a painting where a painter is coming down from the heavens and helping humanely milk a mound. So I'll run you through some of the miracle machines. This is miracle machine number 2, the vegan made egg spit. This is miracle machine number 4, the patented energy saver. Miracle machine number 5, the Deblin technique at work. Deblin was actually Beto's cousin, but I won't get into that. This is miracle machine number 6, Craftmaster. Miracle machine number 11, Musacrilege. This is the very middle of a sweet journey. This is miracle machine number 9, the furnace that burned together goodness. Miracle Machine number 13, Good Vegan. That's a detail of that. This is a miracle machine called Beacon. Miracle Machine number 19, The Hand of Glory. Las Luces, Luces and Losses. Stone Prone. The Abysmal, Dismal, Baptismal. The Cult of Color. In the Blestian Room. The Blestian Room is a cave within a cave within a cave where these wayward-thinking vegans conduct their crazy color rituals away from the purest vegans who are intent on destroying everything that they stand for. So I worked on this body of work for probably 7 years, and along the half-midway point, I knew that there had to be a shift in the behavior of these paintings or of these images, because there was a dissension in the ranks. One of the characters broke free and started to alert the rest of the underworld of this wayward thinking cult. And so there was kind of a paranoia in the underworld. So I thought, how can I make paintings that represent this kind of idea of hiding or being paranoid or running for your life, and extend that over the course of the next several years, so as if to incrementally suck the color out of these paintings. But I wanted it to be this kind of gradual thing, also giving me an opportunity to create a whole new emotional atmosphere for the work. So what I decided to do was to take the full vegans out of the work, so you're not seeing them conduct their activity. Maybe you're just seeing a hand here and there, or maybe a head peeking from around a corner. So I created a new kind of bed of icons that became, you know, more prominent than some of the others. So this hand thing here, and this is a work called Aborted But Beautiful. This is Brisk Bones Befallen. Morsel, bound. Give them an inch, they'll take a foot. The third to the last big hurrah. And I was excited about this work. It's about 6 by 9 feet. And it kind of, to me, had a sound to it after I finished it. It sounded like some sort of a vegan industrial revolution with gears turning and boards clanking together. This is the March of the Ocelanterns. Quick fixing and color mixing. You're late. This is an install shot of in the Blestian Room. So for that body of work, I worked with Harlan and Weaver Press in New York and created a suite of, I think it's 9 color etchings called Theosophied, Theosophied. Ossification being a process of becoming more bone-like, and theosophy, one description is a religion based in the spectrum of color. So one called Sesam, the Disciples. This is Harmony. And I took the title of this one from my favorite television show as a child, The Incredible Hulk, starring Bill Bixby and Lou Ferrigno. When the pilot episode aired, or right before it actually aired, there was a black screen with this ominous hum behind it, and these words, white words, popped up on the screen. In each of us oft-times dwells a mighty and raging fury. Fountain. Aborted but beautiful. And this is a sculpture simply titled Vegan Arm. And this arm extends 9 feet off of the wall and sort of hovers there magically, holding this string with a bucket of Pepto-Bismol attached to it. to me, this was just a kind of a simple gesture. It was more of a drawing to me than it was a sculpture, because I think in terms of drawing. So here we have the ballet that's currently being played in Austin, at Ballet Austin. In 2005, I was approached by Stephen Mills, who's the head choreographer at Ballet Austin, and he wanted to collaborate with a visual artist and use their world as the basis for a new dance piece. So, and he was willing to take that risk, and I was ready to take some risks in terms of my studio development. So we started to work together, and then we brought on a third collaborator, Graham Reynolds, who's the composer, and he's worked in film and theater. So this wasn't anything new for him, but his was an important voice and component to creating the dance piece. So I, of course, wrote it and designed all the anything visual, sets and costumes and stuff like that. So I guess this would be a great place to talk about this point in the story where Beto Wachau, this vegan scientist, he goes through this change where he was brainwashed, and he snaps out of his brainwashing into reality. And when he does, it unlocks this dark nature of his being called the black brain. And at that point, he realizes that he has to shut this whole operation down. He rewires all of his miracle machines to become smearical machines. And instead of shooting out colorful eggs, they shoot out black eggs, which then hatch and become darkness babies. And darkness babies' only reason for existence is to destroy color. I collaborated with the Fabric Workshop to make one of the backdrops for the piece. Fabric Workshop is out of Philadelphia, and they work with artists to make large-scale textile projects and printmaking projects. So I brought them on to help with this, and it's totally hand-sewn. It's 60 feet long and 20 feet tall. All of those trees are hand cut out of felt and then hand sewn onto this support. So after the ballet was over, and this is in 2008, I returned to the studio knowing that nothing but death was going to come in the next few bits of the work. I was ready to kill off Saint Sesame and move on to something else. But before I could, in a very natural way, I decided to try and reconfigure some of those icons that I'd been working with, namely these heads, these kind of paranoid heads. This is a piece called Reveal, and this is a work called Fear. This is the first fear head that I made. I gave myself the challenge of using that head as the basic architecture, and I thought, how many different ways can I make this painting different? So by using the space that's around the head, the space inside the head, and the two eye holes, by manipulating them and using different motifs in them, they would, I guess, illuminate in different ways. This is a work called The Calm. This is Eye Red. A Happy Place. Blue Bald Voice Effects. Hello Hollow Lullaby. A Tippy Head Run. The Crest of Civil Unrest. Give Me My Flowers While I Yet Live, Version 2. Mold. That's a close-up of mold. Duel by a Bleeder. And here we have the works as they appeared in the 2008 show, just titled Fear. And when I stepped back from it, I realized how maybe the experience of working with a stage piece had affected my studio. I feel like I used the wall as a stage, and the paintings for the first time became as dancers on this stage. The Meddler. Munch. This is OK Bouquet Today. And I use this as a jumping off point to make this work, which is Dissension and Dissension. The Bad Promise. So I use that as a jumping off point for this piece, which is was a commission for the Olympic Sculpture Park in Seattle several years ago. And so it's made out of aluminum that, you know, different sheets that are hanging at different levels in space, but from one vantage point they look, you know, unified. And there's vitrines underneath this large hand where people are encouraged to come in from the community and bring their plastic tops and put in the appropriate holes they would help finish out the piece. And this work is called A Better Promise. And this is in my studio in Houston. And you see the color coffin. And this is in Dallas at the Tally Dunn Gallery. Work while it is day, for when night cometh, no man can work. So at this point, I was kind of fully away from the Saint Sesame and the Cult of Color work. And I had quite literally killed off those characters. So I was thinking about death and these ideas of transition already. And then there were some deaths in my family of some very important people. And I was forced to sort of go back to the studio and I guess figure out a way to make work again. In the face of these kinds of losses, I started to reprioritize things. You know, what were the potent, you know, where were the strengths? What were the strengths of my images, and what were the potential of images? So I was literally at this new kind of, there was a mourning phase, and of course, and then this, like, how can I get back on my feet and use this knowledge to propel myself back through space in a meaningful way, and basically just going back to the mirror again. So it came back to a new, what the first image I showed you, Frosty, I kind of had that feeling again in the studio where, okay, I'm at, you know, square one again. And so, you know, there were some kind of sad and tragicomic images that came directly after that. So we have We Done All We Could and None of It's Good. Smoked. I Did It Anyways. You Are What You Meet. Man Don't Work, Don't Eat. Torpedo Boy and Heron Hazel. I Really Do Love Myself. The Doorstop. Like a Thief in the Night, version 1. Like a Thief in the Night, version 2. The Everlasting Arms, version 1. The Everlasting Arms, version 2. Feet. Hot Coals in Soul. And this is a rather large work. And inside of it, part of some of the material are 10 years worth of my collected used odor eaters. And then it all came back to me. The Regent of Positivity. the hiker. One, 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 and one. When they found me, I wasn't there. Waiting. Dead ringer on my phone. She'll know me when she sees me. The moment of truce. You're unfortunate if you're disproportionate, so stop forcing it. This is a piece called Twitty, which is a print that I... It's in a suite that I'm about to go and sign at the St. Louis at the Island Press there, part of Washington University. I did this whole kind of series of prints based on my grandmother's house, and I remember all the motifs and this is the linoleum floor that I grew up laying on and learning how to draw, and I would look up and see my grandmother sitting on the couch making quilts, and so with this body of work, I'm kind of going back all the way and trying to, establish a new foundation with a whole other set of icons that come from a different place than this whole other kind of, more fantasy-based set of icons. And it's interesting to see them start to merge, but... right now I'm at this transitional moment where I'm trying to figure out how those things can actually lock together, or even if they have to at all. But Twitty is my family name, my grandmother, Alma Twitty. So from that, I made this painting, which is 7 by 11 feet, and it's just kind of verbatim the floor tile. That's a close-up. The irreducible crucible. Kept on keeping on. Qui es, or guess who? As you now enliven a test, set an evil new on USA. And that's the longest palindrome I've ever written. Nope, that's not true. I wrote a longer one, sorry. That's the second longest one. Plate of shrimp. The former and the latter. Black Mamba. Frankly, he's disingenuous and he's friends with us. The shame game. The impatience of progress. My first Italian trip, no gas. Dangerous tours and snares. This is the way. The cross of eyes reossifies the loss of lies. Private dancer. If you're too fat, then you should buy clothes that fit. Four hours in this wretched contraption. Quentin Trenton. Hit the ground punching. All things known and nothing to own. Portrait of the artist under night. With the money I have left, all I can do is buy myself some extra time. This is just down the highway a bit. This is a public art project I did for the Dallas Cowboys football stadium called From a Legend to a Choir. And it's a vinyl mural. It's 108 feet long and 3 stories tall. And this is another mural project I did for the Herman Memorial Hospital Children's Cancer Unit in Houston. And this is a work called High and High, and it's a response to the work where the mound is dead and the animals are sad. That work was By and By. So I wanted to, you know, obviously make something that was more life-affirming for sick children. And it was very rewarding. I hear the kids like it, and gives me an opportunity to explore the medicinal qualities of art. And I'll end on this. This is Old Judd, and he's in a film called Eaten Alive, directed by Tobe Hooper, who also directed A Texas Chainsaw Massacre. So a lot of his early films are, he's from Austin, and his works are set in that corridor from Austin on up to northeast Texas. So just the crazy things that happen in the backwoods along Highway 59. The film starts off, you know, at night, and seems to end, it never becomes daytime in this movie. It's a very strange thing. But so Judd has a nervous breakdown. He has a hotel out in the middle of the woods, and people check in, and he seems to be fine. He's wearing his glasses, and once they check in, he takes off his glasses and becomes evil. So in a way, this is the flip of a character, the character from the beginning, who takes off his glasses and becomes more heroic. So Judd goes through this kind of psychological shift in the film several times, and he takes a Grim Reaper sickle to the person and then pushes them off of his porch into a pond that has a giant crocodile in it that he acquired from an illegal animal trader in Florida. Anyway, somewhere in the middle of this movie, Judd retreats to his office area, and he's looking over his receipts and doing paperwork, and he's putting on the glasses and taking them off, and he has several different pairs, and the weird thing is none of the glasses have lenses in them. I don't know if it even makes a difference, but he starts humming this song. And the song, to me, it just was a really kind of a beautiful thing. It was really interesting. And I researched it. I couldn't find any evidence of it on the internet at all. I think the actor, who's amazing, named Neville Brand, he starred in a lot of Westerns in the 50s and 60s. Great actor, but apparently very volatile. He was really... people didn't like to have him on set because he would just fly off the handle and do crazy things. So he was perfect for this movie. But anyway, the song goes, down, round, tumble down, standing round in the rain. Ain't got no ticket, ain't got no bag, still I'm waiting on the train. Thank you. Do we have time for questions, Terry? I don't know what time it is either. Let's see. I don't know. 8:12. There we go. Can we? All right. Yeah. Questions. If there are any. I think I'm going to debut that animation at my drawing survey, which will be at the Contemporary Art Museum in Houston, curated by Valerie Cassell Oliver, in April 2014. So it's something I'm working on behind closed doors, but come on down if you want to check it out.
Tell them again about the ballet. What are the dates, since I messed that up?
So it started last Thursday and will end this Sunday. So I guess that was March 28th to April 7th. And it's called Cult of Color, Call to Color, and it's put on by Ballet Austin.
So it sounds like you're working on this work for the 2014 show. Is it still exploring? Are you still exploring the self? I mean, are the self portraits a part of the direction you're taking?
Yeah. The any new work that I make for the show will be probably have some component of self portraiture. The animation is, yeah, lots of images of my face in it and morphing into weird things, and I'm using my own image as malleable material, I guess. But it'll go all the way back to, say, 1995, gathering up. I guess the purpose of the show is to show what drawing has meant in my studio over the course of the past 20 years. And, it's definitely different things. It's like the idea of making something preliminary that then becomes a larger situation. The drawings sometimes are works on their own. In the instance of the animation, it's, many drawings that, address issues of time. I've done cartoons in the past. Some of those things will show up. And, I think an element of wall drawing will be part of it, and also new wallpaper and stuff like that. So, and also tons of sketchbooks that'll be there. And I don't know, just I'm always drawing. So,
yeah. There was an image you showed us, and I forgot the title, but it's the one in the really long arm that's reaching out of the wall and it's holding the bucket. And you referred to that as more like a drawing.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just curious to know, like, if you have a definition for what a drawing is.
Well, that's something I asked the curator. In an effort to, I guess, narrow down what we could choose from. And so, I see that thing as a drawing in space. I mean, but, at the end of the day, it's a sculpture. And the ballet, to me, is a drawing in space. And, it's a ballet. It's not something else. So we're kind of starting with paper and things that are on paper. But if you see any of my paintings in person, you realize there's drawing provides the skeleton. And in some instances, it's just an issue of going from paper to canvas, like a drawing, like I draw on canvas and call it a painting. So I don't know if I'm a traditional painter. I think I made a painting the other day, but I'm not sure. I may go back and do some things to make it not a painting. But to me, painters use color, like in a way that that's where they start. I start with drawing. Like, I think that's how I think in those terms. So I'm actually fascinated with painters, like Bonnard, like these characters that just use color as material. But I'd like to get there one day, and maybe that would be an extension of my practice where I start making real paintings.
Sir. Can you tell us a little bit more about Plate of Shrimp?
That image, with the hole in the middle and the eyes and the... That came from... the painting itself, I was going to just try and make a larger version of the one that had the palindrome in it. So the As You Now and Live in a Test painting, I wanted to make something that was similar, had a similar energy, but larger. And I have sort of an inability to kind of duplicate myself. So within that process, it started to change. And the mouth in the middle opened up, and I saw space to put another head, and I put a head in there, and I didn't like that, and I cut it up. And but I knew I wanted text to be part of this thing, so I decided on Plate of Shrimp, because I had just watched Repo Man again, and there's that scene where the kind of bum that's a repo man somehow, he's like a wise man, and he's talking to Emilio Estevez, and he's like, you know, you ever heard of the thing he's talking about, the collective unconscious, and this idea that, you know, it's the lattice of coincidence, and you'll hear, you know, maybe somebody say something, and all of a sudden, you know, you keep hearing it. It's like take Plate of Shrimp. It's like, maybe you'll hear somebody say plate, and then next thing you hear someone say shrimp. It's like a plate of shrimp. And so I don't know, something about that had a lot of meaning to me at that particular moment, and that made its way into the mouth of that character, and he's screaming Plate of Shrimp out. It's almost like the painting had revealed something to me that I had forgotten and was unlocked in that moment. So that's kind of, I don't know what else I could say about that one, but that's it. Yeah.
How did your grandma and your mom and stuff nurture those crazy drawings when you were a kid?
Oh, they didn't like some of that stuff. But that fueled my I came from a very Christian household, and you know, I was obsessed with horror movies and Greek mythology and all kinds of stuff that was anti-Christian as they, you know, saw it, you know, wasn't pure. But I think the less pure it was, the more I was interested in it. Not maybe going out and doing crazy things. I just stayed at home and drew, but I felt like I could explore these very taboo ideas. And maybe they weren't taboo in the household that was next to us or down the street or whatever, but in my house, it's like I saw this idea of rules, which some seemed arbitrary, some were based in, you know, biblical text, and I was like, okay, maybe that is sinful, and I really shouldn't be thinking about it, but I kind of like to think about it, and it makes its way through these drawings, and, you know, this actor on TV did it, and maybe I can, you know, I want to make something that is as powerful as this passage in this movie I saw. So I really thought in those terms early on, and it was just almost this competition, like me against pop media and pop culture, fueled by it, but you know, I want to make my own version of it. So that really moved me through space. And, you know, I had the Encyclopedia, you know, Britannica's there, and I'm looking at all the paintings, and there was this kind of really democratic, no hierarchy idea, or unhierarchical idea of what painting was. So I'm looking at, you know, Matisse stuff and then Titian stuff, and it's like, oh, if this encyclopedia says this is all painting, then it must be. So I'd look at Heavy Metal magazine, which was this anthology of different artists making kind of post-apocalyptic cartoons, and there'd be like 10 different cartoons in one under one cover, and every month you'd get it. And so I had this idea that, wouldn't it be cool if this was all one artist making all of these things? So I kind of grew up with this idea that I want to do it all. And so I gravitated to artists that I felt like were capable of understanding lots of things and believing in lots of things. And, you know, monotheism isn't believing in lots of things. It's like very, you know, it's just, that's all you get. And it's very exclusive. And I don't like that idea. So I want my work to have many points of access, but at the same time, I'm a card-carrying elitist. I do have these ideas of what I feel is pure, what is sacred, but at different times in my life, I I like to play the anarchist against myself and say, oh, that's bullshit. Take all of that down and tear down those walls and create this new kind of space. And when that happens, oftentimes it's very abrupt, and I don't know what to think about it, but I know that it's the right thing to do. I believe in images, and I believe images can change people's points of view. And I believe images can soothe you. Sometimes the same image can destroy a nation, and the same image can, be the thing that caresses and brings someone back from the depths of despair. So it's like, so the idea of what truth is in my studio, I'm always challenging these things and just trying to step out of my comfort zone and do new stuff and, have fun with it, but at the same time, nurture my neuroses and turn them into something that's usable.
Yeah. Are you going to have a book published?
There are actually several books out right now. One's called Mia Mound, which you can get on Amazon, I think. I think it might have just gone out of print, but it's been out for about 8 years. There's another one called The Trenton Doyle Handbook, which is kind of a lexicon or encyclopedia of my characters. There's The Wayward Thinker, which was printed in Scotland, which is the catalog for that show, which happened about 6 years ago. The University of South Florida just printed a catalog for their show, We Done All We Could and None of It's Good, that came out last year. So there's things out, and there'll be a catalog for the show that's going to open at the Contemporary Art Museum next year, the drawing show.